We are talking today with Father Roy Bourgeois. Father Roy Bourgeois served as a naval officer for 4 years, spending his final year in Vietnam, and received the Purple Heart. After military service, he entered the Seminary of the Maryknoll Missionary Order and was ordained a Catholic priest in 1972. Father Bourgeois worked with the poor in Bolivia for 5 years before being arrested and deported for speaking out against Bolivian dictator General Hugo Banzer and U.S. policy towards that country. In 1980, he became an outspoken critic of U.S. foreign policy in Latin America after four American churchwomen were raped and killed by a death squad consisting of soldiers from the Salvadoran National Guard. In 1990, he founded the School of the Americas Watch, which focuses on the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia, where 54,000 officers and enlisted men from throughout Latin America have received training in so-called counterinsurgency tactics. Last year, Father Roy Bourgeois received the Thomas Merton Award. Father Bourgeois, I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Good to be with you.
Maybe if we could start out and tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up in Louisiana.
Well, you know, a very traditional setting, a little town, 3,000 people, midway between New Orleans and Baton Rouge, right on the Mississippi River. Hardworking folks, but as I look back on those years, very loving people, you know, blessed with a mom and dad, a brother, two sisters, and everyone settled right there, you know, within 5 miles of each other. I was one of the, actually the only one in my family to sort of want to leave Louisiana. But what I found when I eventually left was that we were cut off there in our little town. I think, as you know, again, loving, hardworking people, we didn't critique our country's foreign policy. We're very loving, very trusting of one another, especially our leaders in Washington. We sort of had the attitude they know what's best for our country. And so for me, it was, you know, the public school, the local school there, falling in love with my high school sweetheart, thinking of, you know, marrying, working, you know, for Kaiser Aluminum there in town, or the sugar plant, sugar refinery. Then when I left high school, in sports were the top issue for me back then, you know. It was a high priority to excel in sports, football, basketball. But then when I went to the university, it was my first touch with a bigger world. And for me, it was frightening. I remember I was so afraid to flunk out of college. I studied geology. I didn't know how to study. But then I had to learn. But those 4 years in college were very challenging years. It opened up to me. It was sort of my stepping stone to the world. My hope then was to get rich as a geologist in the oil fields of Venezuela and to make it, you know, make my million before the age of 30. But then what happened when I eventually left college with that degree, Vietnam was on. And it was, again, I look back on those years of college, and like in my hometown, we weren't challenged. I don't remember being really challenged by, you know, the priest in the local parish. We didn't confront the issue of racism or sexism. It was so alive in our little community there. At the university, I don't recall, maybe they were there, but I didn't go to lectures talking about U.S. foreign policy or critiquing our foreign policy in Latin America or in other places in the world. What happened was when I got out of college, one had a choice. You're going to be drafted or you could volunteer. I became a naval officer, went to officer candidate school and got my commission, and actually thought of making the military a career. It was an adventurous time, 2 years aboard ship, a year at a NATO station in Europe. And that's when I thought I would kind of move up that ladder to enhance my career. When they asked for volunteers to go to Vietnam, I didn't hesitate. I signed up. I was actually in Athens, Greece at the time. Could have ended my Navy career there. But believed our leaders. We had to go to Vietnam, they said, to to stop the spread of communism. Our cause was noble. We're going to be the liberators. The same language you're using toward Iraq today. And I bought that. Didn't really question any of that. I saw it as truth. What I didn't realize at the time was that, politicians and others, leaders of countries, can really live out very easily those words of Isaiah, the Old Testament prophet, who said they will take evil and call it good. They will take a lie and call it truth. And how easy it is to do that. And I bought into the lie. And Vietnam, though, was a turning point when I went there. It was a scary place. It was serious because there was a lot of killing going on. And let me just say, the suffering I saw there, losing friends, wounded there, shook me. My greatest fear in Vietnam wasn't so much being killed as rather than what it would do to my family in Louisiana, my close-knit family. I knew that their lives would never be the same. They would grieve for me for years and have a lot of pain. I didn't want to put them through that. And this is what I'm saying right now to high school students and college students, wherever I speak. You better think about this. I mean, when we're, asked to go to war, first, we're not made for war. As human beings, we can't go about the business of killing and come back home and get on with our lives as before. We're forever changed. Many are, of course, are haunted by the demons. You can't sleep at night, Many, the marriages fall apart. One becomes addicted to drugs. You want to forget. You're haunted. And this is what's happening with so many vets coming back from Iraq. They're struggling with those demons. They'll never be the same again. What I started to think about, though, was, it's just, what happens in war, I think we lose our hope. That's what happens. The joy that we have in our lives, it's killed. It falls apart. We become inhuman. What happened to me, I think, as I look back on that experience, there was a missionary I met near our base. He was a Catholic priest from Canada, many years in Vietnam. He was caring for about 500 children at this orphanage. Their parents had been killed, many of the kids wounded. I would go there with my buddies to help out this old missionary. And I'd never met a priest like him. He was a healer. He was a real peacemaker. He stood out in the midst of the madness of it all. And the more I spent time at the orphanage and saw this priest go about his work, not trying to convert anybody, but simply trying to just be, he was so compassionate. I thought of trying to do something like that with my life. My year was coming to an end. Talked to an army chaplain about missionary work, and he recommended the Marinol Order, group working in 28 countries around the world serving the poor. And I had never heard of them before. My year was up. I came home and was accepted into the Marinol Order, their seminary out east. I remember just when that plane touched down in California from Saigon, I mean, we just wept, so many of us on that plane. We were alive. We were coming home. And it was sort of a new beginning. I remember how wonderful it felt just to be back with family and friends. And what I wanted to do was to try and find hope in life, trying to be a peacemaker, whatever that meant. And those years in the seminary were good years. I grew. I had a lot of time for reflection. It took me 3 years to go on my first demonstration. I had never been on a protest before. Again, coming out of the bayous of Louisiana, we just didn't think about protesting. We saw it as often as unpatriotic. But here I am now, back from Vietnam, 3 years, and I joined hundreds of other veterans in front of the White House And I held a sign that said, you know, stop the war. Bring the troops home. And I remember what I felt that day. It was very empowering. I see that day is somewhat sacred in that when we come to a point in our lives and we start speaking from our own experience, not relying on others to tell us what's truth, and to reflect on my own experience in Vietnam and how wrong it all was and how we tried to justify it, but in the last analysis it was wrong. And this is what I came to, and I had to be honest to that and speak out against the war, as many of us were doing. Thousands taken to the streets. And what I found that day was kindred spirits, people who were who gave me hope. And this is what I learned: when we come together and like that in protest and work for peace, something happens to us. We can't go back to the person we used to be. It's sort of a process that has entered our lives now. We keep getting deeper and deeper into this struggle for peace and justice. And so anyways, I was later ordained a Catholic priest now, and went off to Bolivia to serve the poor. And like Vietnam, Bolivia was a very radicalizing experience. It's where I got educated about my country's foreign policy in Latin America. I lived in a slum for the next 5 years outside of La Paz, the capital. And this became my home. And the people there were very, very good to me, very loving, very kind, the poorest of the poor. They lived in the shacks. They didn't have running water, no lights. They were struggling for survival, the vast majority of the people, as throughout the developing world. Bolivia was being ruled by a brutal dictator, General Hugo Banzer, who came into power through a violent coup. It saddened me to see my country in Bolivia giving training and supporting, propping up this dictator and his thugs who ran the country, the men with the guns, the bullies all over the country who were defending this socioeconomic system that kept this small elite very wealthy and powerful, majority very poor. And and also we had the big corporations that we hear a lot about today, who come into these countries, the developing world as it's referred to, where there are no such things as a minimum wage law. In Georgia you have to pay a worker, it's like $5.30 an hour. I don't know what it is in Washington. Probably a little higher. But in these countries outside of the U.S., there are no such laws. The capitalists, the corporations come in. Latin America, like the conquistadors of the past, you pay whatever you want to. The goal is to make huge profits from cheap labor and the vast resources there. And there are a lot of people who get wealthy from this. And what they get wealthy from, of course, is the blood and sweat, off of the blood and sweat of others. What happens in that situation is people who live like that under such conditions of repression, of poverty, seeing their children go to bed hungry and die before the age of four or five, they do what we would do. They come together and they start organize it. They start confronting those forces at work that keep them living in such inhuman conditions. And they talk about a living wage. They talk about justice. They talk about schools for their kids and hospitals to go to when they're sick. Not a complicated issue here. People who are treated as subhuman will, over time, rebel, speak out. And when the poor start gathering this way, it's dangerous. Many are arrested, many imprisoned, exiled, many are killed. and it's high risk. It was in my fifth year that I was arrested with a group from the university for talking about human rights. I was visiting political prisoners, many from the university. The tin miners were being arrested. I made a in doing my visits in prison, we were able to document a lot of cases of torture. There was a lot of torture going on in the prisons there. As we read about, you know, coming out of Abu Ghraib and Iraq and also Guantanamo. I mean, this is has been going on for a long time. It was very, it was common knowledge that this was going on in Vietnam. We were doing a lot of torture in there. In Bolivia, this dictatorship that we were supporting, it was going on there a lot. We took some cases that we documented, and I went to Washington with this documentation from our Human Rights Commission there in Bolivia and reported to members of Congress our findings. And when I got back to Bolivia, I was called in. They knew somebody had reported me. They knew I was in Washington denouncing this torture. And I was warned that I was being watched, that I better start, I better stop, they said, becoming involved in the internal affairs of Bolivia. And I better stick to just church work, as it, they may basically baptize in babies. But that was short-lived. It was just a couple months later that I was arrested with a group at the university and was forced out of the country. And it was a hard time. I came home and a very lonely time. I didn't know where to go, what to do. My life had revolved around Bolivia for the last 5 years. I'd learned so much there and made such friends there. I felt that was my home. But what happened was I couldn't go back to Bolivia. I was denied a visa. And that's what encouraged me now to turn my attention to El Salvador, a country far worse than the one I just came from, Bolivia. El Salvador was a country where 14 families ended up with 60% of the land. I've never seen anything like El Salvador. I went there after the assassination of Bishop Oscar Romero, this bishop who was killed for his work with the poor, who began to speak on their behalf, knowing the consequences of his words. What really got us involved, many of us from the U.S., was when four churchwomen from the U.S. were raped and killed, who went there at the invitation of Bishop Romero to work with the poor. Two of them were friends. They were nuns of the Maranol community, Maura Clark and Ida Ford. And with them also was among the four churchwomen, an Ursuline nun, Dorothy Kazel, from Cleveland, and a lay missioner by the name of Jean Donovan. When these four churchwomen were killed, it got a lot of press. It brought El Salvador closer to us in the United States because they were our own. And when we went to El Salvador, what we found was a military that was brutal. I was more frightened in El Salvador by what I saw and heard than my experience in Vietnam or Bolivia. I mean, really, it was the slaughter of the innocents. Many people just picked up at night. The knock would come on the door. There's a list of university students. They're campesinos, coffee pickers. They're union organizers, university leaders, anyone who dared to criticize the military who ran the country are critical of U.S. foreign policy there. See, we were deeply involved. We were given millions and millions of dollars in military and economic aid to El Salvador. We were really supplying the guns and the training to those doing the killing. It came down to this. We were complicit in the slaughter of the innocents there. So what happened was I came back from El Salvador now, and a vocal critic of our foreign policy there. And my first protest about El Salvador came when I was on speaking tours in the United States, trying to, again, educate people in the U.S. about what we were doing in El Salvador. Let me say this. I think our greatest enemy in the United States is ignorance. I first saw that in Vietnam, and then later saw it in Bolivia, and now saw it in El Salvador. There's so little that we know about other cultures, other countries with histories and cultures so much older than our own. We don't know their religious beliefs. We don't know their leaders, their histories. And that ignorance gets us in big trouble. We don't know what our foreign policy is doing to the people there, nor do we know how they view us here, the image that they have of us. And I can only say that so many countries that I've gone to in the past, and especially in the present, I mean, we are really disliked. Why? Because for so many years we have been allied not to the to helping the poor, but our foreign policy and economic policies have been there to protect our own economic self-interest. We have been in solidarity with the wealthy elite of that country, who have caused lots of suffering and death to the poor of those countries, who make up the majority. And the people are not ignorant. They know if their government's on their side or not. They know what other countries are helping their dictators. They know what countries, it's not complicated for them. They know what side the United States was on, and it was not on their side. And they saw the United States really as el enemigo, as the enemy, as that country causing a lot of suffering and death to their people. And when I came back from El Salvador, I tried, like many, to educate, to confront the arrogance and the ignorance. But as you know, it's not easy. I mean, I remember, you know, growing up in, again, in Louisiana when I first entered the military, how upset and angry I was with protesters. You know, I mean, my attitude, I remember those cliches, you know, love it or leave it. You know, why don't you just go and live in Russia? But then, if, you know, things happen and you get enlightened, you get educated, it's a lifelong process. And there are experiences in people who really start educating us. And what I saw in El Salvador made me protest when I came back to my country. When 500 soldiers from El Salvador arrived at Fort Benning, Georgia, a big army post in Georgia, in Columbus, Georgia, to start training in combat. This is serious stuff. These Salvadoran soldiers were going to be taught the art of killing. They were going to go back to their countries after these 4 months of intensive combat training, and they were going to kill more people. There was an insurrection in El Salvador. The landless peasants, the poor, the majority of the people there were revolting. They were organizing against the government, at war with them. And the United States wanted to put down that insurrection, that revolt. It was a war against the poor. And so they brought their soldiers here to help do that. But I and friends, three of us actually went to Fort Benning to protest. And our little group of three was Linda Ventimiglia, who was in the Army Reserves, who had had been in the Army, received her own combat training at Fort Benning. She was now again, a U.S. soldier in the reserves. And Larry Rosebaum, an oblate priest who had just come back from his work in Brazil, and I, the three of us, we decided to take a message to the Salvadoran soldiers on Fort Benning. And what we did, we dressed as high-ranking Army officers, purchasing our uniforms at a local Army surplus store. We entered Fort Benning at night, and we had this powerful boom box, and in it was the last sermon of Bishop Oscar Romero. It was his sermon given in the cathedral the day before he was assassinated, when he made a special plea to the men in the military to stop the killing. He said to them, lay down your weapons. Disobey your superior officers who are telling you to kill your fellow campesinos, your brothers and sisters, and obey a higher law that says thou shalt not kill. Bishop Romero was a prophet. He was, of course, a martyr. He was very much like us and wasn't known for his courage, his wisdom. He was a conservative, silent priest who was made bishop, and probably because he was so silent and aloof, that's why he was made bishop. Most of the bishops today are very, very quiet. They don't usually speak out on issues of peace and justice. They're known for raising money for the church, not for raising hell. And Bishop Romero somehow changed. And what changed him was the slaughter of his people. So many were being killed, and he said, I've got a voice, I've got to defend them. As a bishop, I have power, and I must use my voice for the voiceless, for the powerless, knowing the implications of what he was doing. And anyways, it was the next day after his sermon, his appeal to the military to stop the killing, that he, while saying Mass in this church, was assassinated. And he's a martyr. He has become an inspiration to so many in El Salvador and many here in the United States who know of this great person. He gave us a lot of inspiration and courage that night. Linda, Larry, and I, we penetrated this high security area on Fort Benning. We got saluted. We went deep into the woods right near the barracks where the Salvadorans were housed. And with tree climbers, we scaled this tall pine and waited. And about 11 o'clock at night, when the lights went out, we just said, Bishop Romero, this is for you, brother. His voice just boomed into the barracks, and it was like poking a beehive. I mean, it was something. They came out with their guns, and the lights, their dogs, spotted us in the tree, ordered us down, or they would shoot us down, and of course it was time to come down. We came down, left the boom box up there with Romero's message repeated a number of times. They worked us over. They beat us, kicked us around, and then took us to the county jail and then to trial later. And the charges, impersonating Army officers and criminal trespass. And we were sent to prison for a year and a half. It was hard on our family members in that courtroom that day. I remember my mom and dad, my close-knit family from Louisiana, some friends, and they were frightened by it all. They didn't really understand what we were trying to do. They didn't understand what we had seen and heard in places like El Salvador or Bolivia. They didn't understand sort of what I had experienced in Vietnam and what sort of contributed to this. But what I've learned is that we've got to live our own lives. We've got to be honest to our own experiences in life. We can't live our lives always pleasing others not saying or doing things that we know might upset loved ones, and not be true to ourselves. Because many of us, and I've been there, you struggle with that. Do I really do and say what I really believe in, knowing it's going to upset others? Will I live my life just for others, or will I be, you know, true to myself? We all struggle with that. Well, anyways, what I've learned in others in our movement now is that loved ones, friends, you know, they can handle it. We will lose some friends and some support along the way, but so often it brings us closer together. I've seen that with my own family. And that year and a half in prison brought us closer together. Those long letters from prison, which was hard and lonely, but it helped them understand, you know, why I was there. The visits in prison helped them understand why I was there. And no regrets. What I learned in each of us who go to prison for our conscience is we learn that the truth can't be silenced. We speak from prison. And many of us have learned from others who have gone to prison for justice, and civil rights leaders, and people like Gandhi and Cesar Chavez and many others. They teach us things. And we held on to our hope in prison. The joy, unlike war, could not be killed. We got out of prison, great shape. Went back to work, joining thousands around the country, trying to end the military aid to El Salvador. But we couldn't do it. Our voices, we didn't have that kind of power. The military aid got up to $1 million a day to El Salvador, all paid for by our taxes. And the bloodshed continued. November the 16th, 1989, there was another massacre in El Salvador. This time they went after the Jesuit priest. They were scholars there at the university. They were educating not only students in El Salvador, but the world about what was going on in that little country, El Salvador. They were also critics of U.S. foreign policy there. talked about the worship of the idols of wealth and power. That really was at the very core of this issue. The Jesuits run 28 universities in the country, in the U.S. I was at spoke yesterday to the students at Seattle University. They're very influential. They're worldwide. What happened was when they entered the university after midnight that November the 16th, 1989, they dragged these six Jesuits out of their rooms. With them, a young mother, their co-worker, Elba Ramos, and her 15-year-old daughter, Selena. And they were shot at close range. They were blown away, massacred. And this made the front pages of newspapers all over the world. And when it hit the papers here, it really upset a lot of people. Again, the Jesuits are well known. Many of our members of Congress educated by them in their universities and high schools. They sent a congressional task force to investigate, and they come back. They come back upset, this congressional task force. They come back reporting that those who did the killing were trained in the United States, in our backyard, at a big army base down in Georgia, Fort Benning, at a school called the U.S. Army School of the Americas. When I read that report, it got a lot of coverage. I decided to return to Fort Benning to investigate the school. I went down with the support of my Marino community and didn't have to convince them, really, because we work in Latin America, and many countries there know firsthand the brutality of the military. We felt it was important to investigate this school of the Americas that we knew very little about. I found this apartment right outside of the main gate that became the SOA Watch, School of the Americas Watch. We didn't have a movement back then, of course. We just had a few kindred spirits coming into town, friends who I'd called, come down, we've got work to do here. Charlie Litke came in from San Francisco, a Vietnam veteran, the recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor. A Jesuit came in from Boston, two Dominican priests, three Salvadoran university students who had to leave their country with death threats. Kathy Kelly from Chicago came in to join our little motley crew. Kathy went on to co-found Voices in the Wilderness, who's doing a lot today on Iraq. In fact, she's back in Iraq now. We worry about her. Such a dangerous place to be. But the 10 of us, we started to really do research on this issue. Through the Freedom of Information Act, through human rights reports like Amnesty International, who helped us along the way, members of Congress. Here's what we found, some of just the basics. This School of the Americas had been around since 1947. It had trained over 50,000 soldiers from Latin America, all paid for by the U.S. taxpayers. The school was training in combat about 1,500 soldiers a year from 18 countries in Latin America. They learned commando tactics, psychological warfare, counterinsurgency techniques, and later we learned, which got the school in big trouble, they learned the techniques of torture. When that was revealed by the Pentagon, and the Pentagon had no choice because the Washington Post and Representative Joseph Kennedy was getting ready to reveal this information. The Pentagon called a press conference the day before to try and do damage control, but they couldn't. It was serious. It made the front page of the Washington Post. U.S. instructed Latins on executions and torture. And it was about these manuals used as a part of the curriculum at the School of the Americas. Dictators were trained here, like General Hugo Banza, this brutal dictator from Bolivia, not only a graduate, but in 1988 inducted into the school's Hall of Fame, where his photograph was on the wall with 20 other generals, presented as model soldiers. General Manuel Noriega, from Panama, today in a U.S. federal prison in Miami doing 25 years for drug running, another notorious graduate. Death squad leaders went through here like Dubasan from El Salvador. Here's what happened. When the United Nations Truth Commission report was made public and hit the front pages of our newspapers, this report revealed that those who killed Bishop Oscar Romero trained at the School of the Americas. Those who raped and killed the church women were graduates. The 28 who killed the Jesuits and the two women, 19 of them graduates. And really, the list went on and on. And when word began to spread around the country about this school, a movement began to take root and blossom. We started to gather at the main gate of Fort Benning in November to call for the school's closure, to simply say, not in our name, to try and use our voices, as Bishop Romero said, for people whose voices were taken away. That first November, really, we had just about a dozen of us there. Next year, 100 came, and then 500, and then 1,000. Well, this last November, over 19,000 gathered. There were quite a few there from the Seattle area. Over half were college university students who had become the backbone of our movement. We had a lot of veterans there, military vets who see this issue for what it is, bringing shame to our country. A lot of senior citizens, lots of nuns who joined our movement in the very beginning, parents with their children. And we have a lot of speakers, a lot of good musicians. Some celebrities come, like Martin Sheen and Susan Sarandon and others. Pete Seeger was there a few times to ignite the crowd with his music. We have a lot of, the puppeteers are there. We've got a lot of, but let me just say, on Sunday it's more solemn. All these meetings that go on Saturday evening, but Sunday now it's more solemn. We remember the victims in a rather unique way. We have this solemn funeral procession. We carry these thousands, 19,000 are carrying these small white crosses bearing the names of the victims. Some the Star of David they have with the names, photographs of the victims. When we get to the main gate of Fort Benning, that's closed. It's a chain link fence topped with barbed wire with signs that say no trespassing. When we get to the fence, we put our symbols, those crosses and other religious symbols, and the fence, you can't see the other side. And we turn it into this sacred memorial wall. What happens when we're there, some always feel to go to cross the line. They go over the fence or under the fence, and when you do that, you're in trouble. You're breaking the law. You're prosecuted for criminal trespass and brought to trial. And let me just say, over 200 of our people now have gone off to prison. 29 are there now as a result of last November's protest. And when they send us to prison, we again speak from prison. It energizes the movement. It calls more attention to the issue. You know, from the state of Washington, we have had a total of 8 who have gone to prison. From Oregon, we have a total of 7 who have gone there. Let me say now, we have a bill in Congress, a very important bill, H.R. 1217. It calls for the closing of the school. There's going to be a vote probably sometimes next month. And we got good news this morning. Patrick, the legislative aide, met with us for a meeting over breakfast with some of the local organizers today. And he came with good news that Representative Jay Inslee had made a decision just yesterday to sign on to the bill. There have been many, many in this area who are a part of our movement, who have gone to prison, who go down to Georgia every November, and they've been working on Representative Inslee. And, today we got official word that he's signed on to the bill, H.R. 1217. We're also hoping for that kind of response from Representative Dave
Reichert,
who has not yet signed on. So I make an appeal for phone calls and letters to Representative Reinhart. Thank you letters to Representative Inslee to thank him for signing on. One of the issues we can bring up to Representative Reinhart is this issue of money. What many people in our movement are saying is that, among other issues they bring up, that we don't want our money going into a school that's going to cause suffering and death to others. That is such an obstacle to human rights and democracy. We want that money to go to schools for our children, to go to the homeless here, let's say, in Seattle, to go to, you know, programs that are going to help people. Let's send that money to schools in Bolivia. Over $20 million from our taxes every year is being directed to this school. Again, that's bringing shame to our country. Let me just end, too, with a little, and we can continue to talk a little bit. You may have some other things you want to bring up. But another sign of hope. We went to Venezuela last year. We met with President Hugo Chavez. And our meeting what was important. We got right down to it. We came to Venezuela to request that Venezuela will withdraw its troops from the school, a country that had sent over 4,000 soldiers there in the past. And as we know, there are changes taking place in Venezuela and other countries in Latin America today. Somewhat of a sea change going on there. And it was a very cordial meeting in the palace with President Chavez, but he said he had to consult his ministers, some of his military, talk about this. He couldn't make a decision alone. But just 3 weeks later, we got the official word at our national office in Washington, D.C., that Venezuela had made a decision to immediately withdraw their troops, all of their troops, from the school and not participate in this school. And later, we had a quote from President Chavez when he's addressing this issue quite a bit in some of his talks in Venezuela. He spoke at a big church in New York not long ago where he said this, that this school, the training that goes on here, simply deforms the minds of soldiers from Latin America, and Venezuela will not be a part of this. When we got the word from Venezuela that they were withdrawing their troops, we decided at our next big national grassroots meeting in Washington, when leaders from around the country came together representing the SOA Watch movement, we decided to go to other countries in Latin America to request from them to do what Venezuela did, pull out your troops. So just last month, we were in Bolivia for a week. We went to Argentina and Uruguay, and we met with the president of Bolivia and the defense ministers of Argentina and Uruguay. And I'm happy to say that the day after we met with the defense ministers of Argentina and Uruguay, these two countries have made a decision now to pull out their troops. They're no longer there. And they won't, as the defense minister of Argentina said to us, esta escuela no debe existir. This school should not exist. And in our meetings with these ministers and many of their senators, and we were often interrupted. And they said to us, you know, we know this school very well. We have been on the receiving end. We know our well-known graduates and what they have done to our people. Over 30,000 in Argentina killed by the military. In Uruguay, many, many imprisoned, killed there. In Bolivia, we met with President Evo Morales, the new president of Bolivia, where there's a lot of hope. He's the first indigenous president ever in the country of Bolivia, a country that has the majority who are indigenous, the Aymara and the Quechua. Bolivia will do it. It's just going to take probably another month or two, but they will pull out their troops. Let me just say what we found going on in Latin America is very significant. They talk about this time as being a historic moment. They're talking about this being a time of hope. For many, many years, these countries like Bolivia, Argentina, Chile, Peru, Uruguay, Paraguay, they've all lived under very brutal militaries, supported by the United States, who had their soldiers trained here in our country at this school. And they know firsthand the brutality of their militaries toward their people. And something's going on now, this fear that was so alive in these countries for so long, so many killed, so many afraid to come forward to talk about the torture, their own or the torture of loved ones, in fear that they would be killed or relatives would be killed. That fear today is gone. It's been replaced by hope. And also this lack of fear, where they're coming forward now by the hundreds in each of these countries, and they're talking about what happened to them and their loved ones. And they're also calling for this impunity to end. These military thugs had so much power. They simply gave themselves immunity. You could not touch them for their crimes against humanity. Well, they're bringing them to trial now, and what they're saying is that there will never be healing in our country until there is truth, until there is an acknowledgement of wrongdoing. And this is what's going on now in Latin America. And they know very well, of course, the history of our country in connection with all of this suffering and death that's gone on in their countries in the past. So we're confident that we're going to get more countries to withdraw their troops. Now, we've been so encouraged by our recent trip to Latin America. In August, our small delegation representing the movement, we're going to Chile, we're going to Peru, we're going to Ecuador, and we're going to meet with their presidents, defense ministers, leaders from their social movements there, human rights groups, and indigenous leaders. And we are hopeful that these countries will join, Venezuela and Argentina and Uruguay and withdraw their troops. I can only say that we're not going away. We feel a lot of hope at this moment in the struggle. This coming November, we're going to be back at the main gate of Fort Benning for our largest demonstration. We're going to have over 20,000 this year. I extend an invitation to our listeners for more information about our movement and about this issue. I would ask that you go to our website with a lot of information about the present bill, H.R. 1217, about the November protest. There will be many coming in, coming to Georgia from this area of the country, Seattle and other parts of the state. But the website is www.soaw.org. Again, that's soaw.org. Bishop Oscar Romero, who has been such an inspiration to our movement, to so many in Latin America, before he was assassinated, he said, let those who have a voice come forward and speak for the voiceless. Speak for peace. And really, this is, I think, the message. If we're silent, now is the time to break that silence, to talk about this issue, to call for the closing of this school, also to call for this war, this madness in Iraq to stop, to bring the troops home. Let this war come to an end. More than enough, too many people have died there in Iraq. So many of our own soldiers who have gone there. So many people grieving there and here. This is madness. And for the students who might be listening in, I say, you have a choice. That recruiter may be asking you in your high school at your university to go off to Iraq. To go to war. You better think about it. There's nothing more serious to give your life for a cause. What you also should know is this, that if you go, you may be asked to be in that position where you have to kill another person, ask if you can take the life of another human being, because that is some serious stuff there. Many believe they can do that or don't even think it through, and when that happens, you're haunted for the rest of your life. You will never sleep well again. Also knowing that if you are killed, and there's a good possibility you will die in this war, because it's so dangerous, think about what it's going to do to your loved ones, whether you are willing or believe in this cause so much that you are going to put you're willing to put your loved ones, your parents or spouse, children, siblings, through all this pain and grieving for many, many years. Their lives will never be the same. And lastly, I want you to think about this. Those who have declared this war, those macho-talking politicians, will not be going. They will talk about, we got to stay tough. President Bush, just two nights ago, I heard him say, you know, we have to keep sacrificing. Well, when he says this, we have to keep sacrificing, he's not talking about himself. He's not going to sacrifice anything. He will continue to live his same lifestyle and have his comfort and security at the White House, and he will not go off to this war and put his body on the line. His life is not in danger. Nor will his sons and daughters, the politicians, those who declare the war, their sons and daughters will not go. Those who declare the war will not fight it, nor will their children. They will send you. And I wish I had it back in the days of Vietnam, someone to challenge me that I had a choice, that I have a choice. I have a choice. And one last thing, a model for me, an inspiration, is a young soldier at Fort Benning who I met with just a number of times recently, Catherine Chijinsky. She's 23 years old. She's from Texas. Her unit arrived at Fort Benning to receive their weapons training to go off to Iraq. And it was on the firing range during the weapons training, using that M16. She had to ask that basic question, am I ready, am I willing, and am I able to take the life of another human being? She was fortunate she asked that question. Most of us, we're mindless, we don't ask that question. And by the time we get off to Iraq or Vietnam, it's too late. Or Iran, it's too late. And she asked that question, and she came up, she came to the conclusion, no, I cannot take the life of another human being. I'm not going off to this war. They're going to be court-martialing her soon. And she said this, that I'm willing to go to prison rather than take the life of another person, perhaps even a child. And I'd rather go to prison and be free, live with my conscience as a free person, than be haunted for the rest of my life for doing something that I know is wrong and immoral. And I mention Catherine because I think especially for high school students, college students, the youth of our country, I think Catherine is a real model, someone we can learn from, and to remind us that we do have a choice when it comes to war.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you.
We've just been talking with Father Roy Bourgeois, founder of School of the America's Watch. And again, you can find out more about their organization at their website, soaw.org.